options and ongoing things. And obviously, for these regions, the impacts of climate change are being felt already, and they're quite substantially affected by a lot of the impacts that I'll be talking about now as well. So yeah, it was a really, really interesting impression on that. So as Malte already said, we recently published a study to understand a little bit better what the impacts might be, or what actually the relevance of these temperature limits that we're looking at of 1.5 and 2 degrees actually are. And we're really interested to understand a little bit better in which regions this half degree between 1.5 and 2 degrees actually makes a difference. I have three things that I'll touch upon. I'll just give a very brief context of these temperature goals in the Paris Agreement and how they got to be. And the main part, obviously, will be on this 0.5 difference and impacts across sectors and regions. And then I'll just give a very, very quick snapshot of potential research perspective in that context. So I'm sure you've all seen this Article 2 of the Paris Agreement that specifically references a long-term temperature goal as a means of preventing a dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. So this specifically references that the aim is to hold the increase in global average temperature to well below 2 degrees and also pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees. And I think what's really interesting about this article as well is the specific reference to the scientific underpinnings of this global temperature goal, namely that it recognizes that it would significantly reduce risks and impacts of climate change if we actually do limit climate change to this 1.5 target. Now, the 2 degree target kind of did go as a red thread for quite a long time through the international negotiations, but this reference to 1.5 actually did surprise quite a few people in the negotiations. So just as a very brief, quick glimpse overview of the emergence of this long-term temperature goal as a central part of the agreement, back in 1996, the 2 degree target was really first mentioned at the EU level and was reaffirmed throughout the negotiations. In 2009 in Copenhagen, generally the outcome of these negotiations wasn't seen as the hugest success, but there's actually two main things that were established in the context of this negotiation meeting. On the one hand, the 2 degree target was actually specifically mentioned in this Copenhagen Accord, but also there was an agreement to review the adequacy of this temperature goal on the basis of available scientific literature in order to understand better what a safe limit would actually be. And this is also the consequence partly of the fact that since 2009, the most vulnerable countries, which include the small island states and the least developed countries, started calling for a 1.5 limit, actually recognizing that this would be much safer for them, actually. So the scientific review was established under the UN FCCC and called the Structured Expert Dialogue, with the goal to really review the adequacy of this 2 degree goal. The review went on over a period of about 2 years, from 2013 to 2015, and was actually finished just in time for the Paris negotiations. Some of the key outcomes of this review were really that the warming of 2 degrees, really on the basis of scientific findings that were available then, cannot be considered safe, so it's actually inadequate as a safe limit. And 1.5 would get us much closer to a safer guardrail, even though looking at the impact, still this can't really be considered as a safe guardrail. But it also recognizes that the science that underpins these impacts at 1.5 degrees is much less robust. Just giving a quick overview of the emergence or development of our understanding of risks and impacts until then. So these burning embers diagrams or reasons for concerns, as they're summarizing the IPCC, if we look at these from 2001 to 2009, it's quite visible already that the scientific or the information that we have on potential impacts in important sectors really increasingly shows that risks are likely to be higher already at lower levels of warming. So really here that between 1.5 and 2 degrees in 2009 is already recognized that these might be much more severe than initially thought. That kind of follows through also to the most recent assessment report where risks are assessed as even potentially more severe. However, of course, this aggregation to five main RFCs and this global aggregation doesn't really give much information on specific impacts and also specific regions that would especially be at risk. So our study really aims at filling these gaps and really looks in more detail both at the global distribution of impacts in 11 kind of biophysical impact sectors, but also looked at a more specific regional distribution. So we looked at 26 regions and aggregated impacts over these regions. I don't want to go into too much technical detail of the study, but just a very, very brief overview of the main aspects that we looked at, or at the main methodological underpinnings. So we looked at impacts over the global landmass, so between 66 degrees north and south, and aggregated over the whole landmass, but also looked in the world regions. And we used the whole range of models, or the whole model ensemble available in the CMIP5 archive, and for the actual impact models, so more water availability as well as agricultural impacts, we looked at also modeling intercomparison data, which also gave us a range of results. So the EZMIP project that actually stands for Intersectoral Impact Model Intercomparison Project, I think. To address impacts at 1.5 and 2 degrees, we looked at 20-year time slices for each model at the point in time where that model actually reaches 1.5 and 2 degrees. So we really, it's more model independent to really look at a function of the impacts at a specific temperature increase. This plot here on the right hand side is actually quite central to the study. So in this case, this is an example of the global land area, but we didn't aggregate over the land area, but looked at each grid point in the specific area that we looked at. And that really gives us these functions of values over the whole area. So we can really also look at extremes in more localized areas rather than aggregate over the whole area. So the plot that we just saw was also the same one as this one. So what we see, we can, so the black line really always gives us the reference scenario, whereas the blue and red line show the changes to 1.5 and 2 degrees respectively. The actual lines show the median projections, and the spread is the likely range that is given by the models. So as we see here, this is the example of temperature extremes, so the annual maximum temperature. And here we really see already an indication that the changes between the reference to 1.5 and 2 degrees are actually significant, or are likely to be significant, because the likely ranges don't overlap. We did test that also further, but I'll just refer to these plots for the purpose of this talk. So in terms of
reference is today's levels.
Reference is a recent past, essentially, so 1986 to 2005. And the 2 degrees and 1.5 increase is always relative to pre-industrial levels, but the actual impact increase refers to the recent past. So that would then actually be 0.9 and 0.4, assuming that we already have a temperature increase of 0.6 until that reference level. Kind of looking at the global changes in temperature increase, we see that at 2 degrees, about 50%, so yeah, 50% line is always also given in each of the plots. So 50% of the global landmass would experience quite significant increases in heat extremes of close to 2 standard deviations relative to to this recent past, and that risk would be reduced to closer to one standard deviation for 1.5 degrees. So really, that's quite a significant difference. If we look at the more kind of unusual events, so those that can be considered under current conditions, that would be the 1% extremes in that distribution. For 80% of the global landmass, these extremes would really become the new normal, and that could be reduced to about 60% of the global landmass under 1.5 degrees. Looking at the same indicator for tropical regions, we see that the the increase in extremes is actually much more intense for tropical regions, where actually three standard deviations or three sigma events would actually become the new normal at 2 degrees. So really, that shifts to outside outside the natural variability levels, essentially. In addition to the intensity of hot extremes, so the annual maximum temperature, we also looked at the changes in the duration of hot extremes, so the additional number of days that heat waves would last under 1.5 and 2 degrees. And what we see here is that the distribution actually shifts quite a bit for the duration, and for 25% of the global landmass, there's actually an overproportional increase in the duration of heat waves, with increases of over 80 days at 2 degrees, which would be or could be reduced to about 50 days for a 1.5 global temperature increase, which is still substantial, but is shorter by a month. So, and these are the same plots showing the changes for northern and southern or central Australia here, and especially for northern Australia, we see the same kind of increase for the duration of heat waves. So it's really quite a substantial increase in heat wave days for northern Australia. So if we summarize that in numbers, we see that the extreme temperatures are likely to exceed 3 degrees above the recent past at 2 degrees, and that could be reduced to a 2 degree increase under or at a 1.5 global average warming. But still, the mean annual length of warm spells would increase quite significantly, especially in the north, where they could increase up to 60 days at 2 degrees, and that risk could be half of that, of about 30 to 40 days at 1.5 degrees. We also looked at changes in precipitation-related extremes, and as we can see here, I'm in the plot for changes in annual water availability. We don't really see a shift at the global level for these indicators, and it's more that regional hotspots of change emerge in terms of these precipitation-related extremes rather than a global signal. And there's a tendency for dry regions to get drier and wet regions to get wetter. And one of the most striking examples here is the Mediterranean region that is already quite water scarce. Mm-hmm. And on annual average, it is likely to experience a 9% reduction at 1.5 degrees, which is projected to double to 17% at a 2 degree warming, which is really quite substantial for this already very dry region. We also looked at an indicator that shows the potential for additional drought-related extremes across the regions, so changes in consecutive dry days. That doesn't necessarily mean there's a drought, but it increases the likelihood for droughts. Here again, a similar picture emerges for the global land area, so there isn't really a discernible change at the global level. But again, the Mediterranean region would, for example, experience quite an intense increase in dry days, both at a 1.5 degree warming and at a 2 degree warming. So again, looking here at the currently unusual events, these would be expected to become kind of the new normal for about 20% of the land area under a 2 degree warming, and that risk could be reduced to about 5% of the land area. And if we look at the recent drought in the region, that has been identified as a potential contributor to the instability in the region as well, that could have quite serious implication for the future as well. In terms of extreme precipitation, one of the hotspots of potential extremes emerges over Northern Europe, where we see quite a shift in distributions as well. The indicator that we used here is the increase in the annual maximum 5-day precipitation. And here an increase of about 8% is projected under 2-degree warming, and that reduces to about 6% at 1.5 degrees. And about 15% of the land area would then really shift to those those conditions that would be considered unusual in the recent past under a 2-degree warming. And that's also this year kind of does see quite a few of the extremes actually showing some indications that we are already approaching some important impacts. I'm not sure if you've heard this at this side of the globe, but Germany has seen quite some intense extreme precipitation in the summer, where little creeks actually turned into large rivers and actually destroyed whole villages. So that was quite intense. We also looked at impacts on global crop yields. The models projecting or looking at changes in crop yields are a little bit more more uncertain, really, or there's a larger modeling range than in the climate models, which is also related to a lot of management issues that have to be included in agricultural models, for example. So the spread in these models is much larger than we see in the climate related impacts, or purely climate related impacts. This here gives an overview of potential changes in the four major crops that these models usually look at on the left for 1.5 degrees and for 2 degrees. And what we see here in bold are the median projections for globals as well as looking at the tropical regions. And this in brackets shows the likely range. So what we see here is that median projections, especially for the tropics, project quite some strong reductions in yields, especially for wheat. The median projections at the global level aren't as dire, I guess, as for the tropical regions. But if we look at the likely ranges here, then we also see some potential really strong reductions, especially for maize yields, if we look at that. What's also quite important for agricultural models is that it is likely that the increased CO2 concentrations in the air would also lead to increasing yields, potentially. So these projections here assume a full fertilization effect, CO2 fertilization effect. There are, however, also model runs that exclude the CO2 fertilization effect. So we see here the full lines are those projections looking at the CO2 fertilization effects, and the dashed lines are those without CO2 fertilization. And there are some recent studies that show that it's likely that yields might increase, but that nutritional value of the crops might actually reduce. So we have more absolute yields, but it's actually less nutritious, and also that crops will likely be more susceptible to pests and other kinds of diseases. So really, it's quite unlikely that this full CO2 fertilization effect will actually materialize. And if we look at the projections that are then really potentially at the lower range of changes, then we actually see substantial reductions in all tropical agricultural areas for all crops in this case. And a similar picture emerges also for the global changes in yields. We also looked at potential impacts on oceanic systems. Here the approach is a little bit different because the dependence on the temperature pathway over time is much more important for these kinds of impacts, so you can't really use this global mean temperature approach that we looked for the other approaches. The upper panels here show kind of representative or potential pathways of temperature development over the course of the 21st century. And we see here the white line shows the 50% chance of actually staying below 1.5 on the left and 2 degrees on the right. But we see that the likely range of these projections also shows some potential for overshooting these temperatures. The lower panels then show what the potential sea level rise would be resulting from these temperature levels. And we do see that there is quite a difference between 1.5 or a difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees. I'll show the numbers in a second, but it's about 10 centimeters for the medium projections. But of course, what's really important for sea level rise is that this plot stops here in 2100, but the line obviously wouldn't. So it's not just the absolute level of sea level rise towards the end of the century, but what's also really important is the rate of sea level rise that is associated with these levels of warming, because they really determine the long-term commitment or the long-term contribution of temperature. So the median projections for the rates of sea level rise are actually lower for 4 millimeters per year for the 1.5 projections and 5.5 millimeters for the 2 degree projections. But it's also quite important to note that the rate of sea level rise is likely to slow down towards the end of the century for 1.5 projections, where they're not projected to slow down yet for the 2 degree projections. So the long-term commitment is quite different. For oceanic impacts, it's also quite important, or the coral reefs are actually one of those ecosystems probably most at risk from temperature change. These projections for coral reef degradation are based on the same temperature trajectory that we used for the sea level rise projections. And what we see here, both for the 1.5 case and the 2 degree case, are two implementations of the model. The constant case actually assumes adaptation rates as they have been observed in ecosystems in the past. And it's quite important to note that this thermal adaptation case actually assumes extremely optimistic adaptation potentials for this ecosystem that have never been observed actually in real life. So it's quite unlikely that coral reefs will actually be able to adapt in the way that this thermal adaptation case shows. What we see here is that assuming what we've seen in the past, so this constant case, under a 2 degree warming, actually all coral reefs are at severe risk of degradation starting basically in 2040 already. And there's some risk of some potential for recovery under a 1.5 degree scenario. So really, for coral reefs, even 1.5 are likely to be rather destructive, but there's some chance for some recovery under a 1.5 pathway. These really strong impacts for coral reefs due to sea level or sea surface warming are actually also seen this year or over the past 2 years, where we see an unprecedented global mass coral bleaching event, which is also related to a strong El Nino over the last 2 years. And this is a study that was done for the Great Barrier Reef, and it actually shows that about 93% of the reef have been bleached up until April, with very severe also mortality and bleaching, especially in the northern parts of the reef. And these are also the areas that are projected to experience much increased heat waves, so that really does paint a bit of a dire picture for coral reefs, I guess. In a recent summarizing study, colleagues actually looked also at potential tipping points in the Earth system and looked at understanding better which models actually project these tipping points to happen at which temperature increase. They looked at 37 different potential tipping points, including different changes like biome changes, permafrost, ocean circulations, and the likes. And looking at the results here, we see that about 50% of thresholds of these abrupt changes are likely to be crossed already at a 2 degree temperature increase. And these risks could be quite strongly reduced to about 20% under a 1.5 degree warming. So really, you see here in this plot the distribution of triggering tipping points at different temperature levels. So that really, I think, summarizes quite nicely also that Our study already shows that there are quite strong differences between 1.5 and 2 degrees, but really we assume a kind of linearity almost, or a direct relation between temperature and the impact. But obviously that doesn't include potential tipping points like that, and it's quite important to really factor that in as well. That already brings me to some points on research perspectives that I personally see as very important. Obviously, there are plenty of avenues that could be explored as well in the context of impacts and 1.5 and 2 degrees. But I think what's quite important, and also what our study showed us, is that the pathway dependency on temperature trajectories is really actually very important for impacts. And the current scenarios that we have are not necessarily targeted at these lower levels of warming of 1.5 and 2 degree pathways. So this RCP setup really looks at usually very much higher levels of warming towards the end of the century. And there are some models or some pathways that would allow to look at 1.5 impacts, but really, the current scenario setup is not necessarily targeted at that. But it would be really important to understand better what the impacts over time would actually be, to understand better time-lagged impacts, as for example for oceanic ecosystems, but also potential reversibility of certain impacts. So really to have a better understanding also of the trade-offs between mitigation and adaptation and the actual costs of impacts, a better integration of scenarios would really be needed. And since I personally am also very interested in adaptation pathways, I think this is a really, really important aspect as well. Our study at this rather coarse level, looking at global models, also already shows quite large differences in impacts between regions and also between warming levels. But of course, still this kind of resolution still doesn't really allow to look at targeted adaptation and really understand what the needs there are. So in addition to the pathway information, really more localized studies would also be needed in addition. And I guess one additional thing that is kind of on the short term, a lot of the two things that I just mentioned and other things as well would really be long-term research perspectives. But one important outcome of Paris was also that it calls for a special report on 1.5 degree impacts and also pathways. And this special report is supposed to be published, or the scoping of it is starting already now, and it's supposed to be published in 2018. So there's obviously limited time to really do substantial additional research going very deep. And what we did is essentially also reanalyze existing data to really understand better the near-term impacts and impacts at 1.5 degrees. So I think this is a really important short-term way forward to increase our knowledge on that.
A brief chance for questions of clarification before we come to Urban Jackson. Just clarification, please. Longer discussion than afterwards. Thank you. And please introduce yourself, although everybody knows you.
David Sprunt. On your sea level rise, speaking of about 0.4 of a metre by 2100, I assume that is thermal expansion only and no contribution from ice mass loss?
I'm pretty sure that's correct, yes. So, but that, yeah, that's
Sorry. Alan Barley, just one question on coral. Does that loss of coral projected take account of migration southward?
Of corals, no, it doesn't. It's a rather simple model, just based on thermal thresholds to understand what current impacts would be. So one would hope that it's actually somewhere in between the very.
It looks at 1,860 coral reef spots in the coral reef database and looking specifically at the temperature. Any further questions for clarifications? Good. Then yes.
Hi, I'm Sonia, a student here at the Climate Energy College. For your 1.5 and 2 degrees scenarios, I think I missed it at the start. Is that based on the RCP scenarios, or how?
Well, it is based, we took all of the RCP 8.5 runs, but we looked at when the specific model reaches 1.5 or 2 degrees at the 20-year, on 20-year average. And then,
thank you. With that, the floor over to Evan Jackson, and then we come to the discussion. Thank you again.
Thank you, Tapia, and I thank you for the opportunity to give some thoughts as well, Malta. I've been asked to sort of give a bit of give some thoughts on the policy, sort of political context. The first thing that always strikes me when I see presentations like this is that we have lots of conversations about 2 degrees versus 1.5, and none of them seem very safe to me. But that's one of the challenges that we all have going forward. And I think one of the things that really struck me by the presentation, and I was fortunate enough to be in a presentation that Tavi also gave some businesses on this yesterday, is that we really need to find a way to, in terms of the politics and actually ensuring that we're actually getting both adaptation and mitigation right, find a way to actually start mainstreaming these kinds of assessments across a broader range of economic and policy-making actors. And just to reflect on what was talked about there in terms of what was happening in the Mediterranean, we need to, in terms of if we are going to get effective policy action in the longer term, we need to find a way to take these kinds of assessments and engage with people like defence agencies in more detail. We need to find a way to ensure that the mainstream economic actors in policy-making are also starting to understand what an extended heat wave of 80-odd days at 40 degrees means for Adelaide. In terms of what it means for their economy. But also critically, I think, what it actually means for investment decisions. So I think one of the things that's really struck me in terms of the policy conversation at a global level in the last few years, but also particularly in Australia, has been that investors have become much more active and are actually becoming a much more powerful vehicle to drive change within traditional companies in terms of the investments they make. So some of the work that we've been doing recently is thinking about the kinds of impacts that climate change might have on the property market. That then translates to how the property market actually and banks and other and insurance companies actually invest, which actually helps us build resilience, but it also gives us an insight and a political momentum towards stronger mitigation, because the costs of some of these adaptation options are probably going to be quite large. But I think at the end of the day, what we need to do with these kinds of assessments, and this is where the IPCC report in 2018 is actually going to be really an important first step, is if you think of the what Tavi put up there earlier about how in the history of the negotiations, how the 1.5 degree language emerged within the negotiation, it was really driven by the majority of countries who recognised that it was in their national interest not to have warming at 2 degrees, but we need it at 1.5. And if we are actually going to get to the kinds of levels of warming that we need bigger emitters effectively doing that as well. So we actually need to shift the conversation, and hopefully the IPCC report will help do this, is shift the conversation into what does this mean for national interest of China, or what does it mean for the national interest of the United States, and particularly in our own country, what does this mean for us? And that's in part why I think broadening out the language and broadening the assessment to actually get more mainstream economic actors involved in the conversations becomes really important. I think the other thing that strikes me about this is that in terms of, again, building momentum around policy, is I was struck by a comment yesterday made by someone in the close small group that we had, which was, this is just all too hard. And this is the essential reaction that you get to a lot of these kinds of scenarios, is that people throw up their hands, well, governments are never going to put us on an emissions pathway that's consistent with getting us anywhere near where it's going to save the people in the Pacific or the least developed countries. So alongside these kinds of assessments, we actually need to be really clear and develop the real credible emissions pathways consistent with deliver the outcomes that we're talking about. And the key word here I'm talking about is credible. We know that the carbon budget for 1.5 degree might be gone, or getting pretty close. It doesn't necessarily help, I don't think, in the political economy to say that the carbon budget has run out. But at the same time, if we are going to achieve the kinds of emission reductions and emissions pathways consistent with 1.5, we need large amounts of negative emissions towards the end of this century. So we need to actually define ways to actually demonstrate in the short term, through technology developments, policy making, that those kinds of negative emission options are a real credible option in the longer term. Because if we don't actually start to tie what the impacts are with credible emission pathways that will actually deliver us the outcomes we want, then people are not going to respond in an appropriate way and just going to throw their hands up and say, we can't really do anything, and we can accept 3 to 4 degrees, and that's all okay. I think the other core part here is, for me, is in the policymaking sphere, is that sometimes we forget our own power. Because the heart and the soul of the Paris Agreement is really a system where peer and civil society accountability hold governments credible for the objectives that they've signed up to. So the Australian government this year, as it would say, said we were one of the first countries to sign the Paris Agreement, but we have an emissions trajectory consistent with 3 to 4 degrees, not 1.5 to 2. And I think one of the key challenges that we have is actually holding governments accountable to the promises that they've made, and ensuring that when they are doing their domestic policy reviews, they're considering that 1.5 to 2 degrees in the Australian context is not good for us, the impacts would be quite severe, but also that it's in our national interest, our policy frameworks, that will deliver on those objectives. And next year's climate policy review is the first real opportunity we're going to have that in Australia, post-Paris. And there are two key things within that which I think will be quite important in the context of holding the government accountable to the 1.5 to 2 degree objectives. The first is that it's agreed to consider a long-term target to 2050. And I say consider because that's the words that they use, so we need to hold them accountable to the fact that they actually will implement them, given that, particularly again in Paris, it was agreed that countries were invited to put forward long-term strategies to 2050 by 2020, and Australia certainly should be doing that. But again, it should be absolutely consistent with the objectives of the Paris Agreement, because at the moment, the only thing that they're going to consider in setting the long-term target is technology development and international developments. You could argue that international development includes the Paris Agreement, but there's no reference in there to science. So are they going to consider, when they do their long-term trajectory, a carbon budget consistent with 1.5 degrees, or are they going to assume we can go merrily along until 2030 or 2040 and then go to net zero emissions in 10 years? The other thing that's going to be really critical is the actual policy framework that we actually put in place to meet any objectives. We are seeing in the political context at the moment some encouraging signs from both sides of politics that we will get a bipartisan outcome at some point in the next couple of years. That's critical from the point of view we're not going to get the large-scale investment we need without a bipartisan outcome. Investors aren't going to commit billions of dollars to new infrastructure unless they think that it's got political longevity. But at the same time, we can't just accept any old bipartisan outcome, because there is a real risk, and I think the political momentum is heading in this direction, that we basically get a very weak carbon pricing mechanism implemented, which has no impact on electricity prices, and which actually does not deliver any real fundamental substantive change in decarbonising the electricity sector over the next few years. So we have a bit of a job, I think, over the next little while to make sure that we're holding our government accountable to the 1.5 2-degree goals and making sure that the policy framework we have is consistent with that. So does it get us on a pathway to net zero emissions sooner rather than later, and does it get us on a pathway to exit our existing coal-fired generation fleet and replacing it with clean energy? Pretty toot sweet. Thank you.
Thank you, Irvin. And for those who don't know, Irvin Jackson is Deputy Director of the Climate Institute and follows every footstep of the Australian delegations around the globe, to the extent that he's considered a member of the Australian delegation. Now, please, maybe you both come forward, please, questions, discussion.
Yes.
Alan Barley, I just wanted to ask you about the question of risk. You know, we seem to be wedded to 50%, 66%, when the real important level at which we should assess the real risk to us is probably more like 1%, or maybe 10 if we're optimistic. Could you comment on that a little bit?
I think it's a really important question and also discussion. And risk essentially is not just the likelihood, but also the in combination with the severity of the outcome. And we're not actually going there yet in this assessment. So it's obviously it would be a really important discussion, especially looking at what other levels of risks are acceptable for other areas. Definitely. itself.
And I think this also, to me, goes to the point of us talking about the tools for many people in across broader society. Like, you know, we have actuaries out there who are very good at assessing risk. And we need to be finding and taking the kinds of results that we're seeing, the work that Toby is doing, and actually and engaging with a broader section of the business community, for example, to actually get them to be doing proper risk assessments. And part of the reason I think that's important is, A, it actually helps them make better decisions, which is, can be good for us. But I also think it would actually highlight the big missing picture that we often have, is that we're not highlighting the risks of the catastrophic impacts enough. And, you know, if we have a 10% risk of a catastrophic outcome, even at 2 degrees, then that's probably something we would want to avoid. And that's more of the conversation that we need to have with a broader section of society.
The UNFCCC goals, which were or do underlie policy making, are, and I quote, to ensure that food production is not threatened and to achieve a time frame sufficient to allow ecosystems to adapt naturally to climate change, unquote. Do you think that for all practical purposes those goals have been discarded? And if they have, what are the current goals that underline policy making?
Well, in the past, it's mixed amongst countries. Like, and the reason I'll answer this in a roundabout kind of way. If you look at the targets that were put forward in advance of Paris, and you look at the cross section of the targets, and you look at which countries justified the targets that they put forward against the 2 degree goal, which was what the benchmark, one of the benchmarks they were asked to assess against. There's actually not a. There were actually quite a few countries who did that. They defined what their own justification for equity was. Like, if you're Bangladesh, they said that our per capita emissions will never go above the level that developing countries should have in a 1.5 degree world, and that's how they defined their longer term ambitions. If you're Switzerland, they said, well, our per capita emissions need to get down to levels consistent with less than 2 degrees by 2050. So countries have started to do that. In practical terms, the kinds of things that you're looking at really don't play into headline mitigation policy. What does, in practical terms, is the temperature goals. And this is why I say that the accountability becomes really important amongst civil society and amongst other countries, in terms of, because countries have said that we will be pursuing efforts to do 1.5 to 2 degrees. The only way that that's going to happen is if there's pressure put on them to actually deliver on it. Because as we know, as in the Australian case, they didn't justify the target they put forward in advance of Paris against the 2 degree goal. They just said it's okay because we've got really high per capita emissions, haven't done very much for the last 20 or 30 years. We should be rewarded for still having very high per capita emissions. Now, that's not exactly what they said, but that's how I would characterise what they said. So we need to make, and this is where the accountability, I think, becomes really important. So if we let governments off the hook, they won't do it. If we hold them accountable, then they're more likely to. And I think this is where businesses and investors are also going to be important, because regardless of what governments do, I was in a meeting just recently with one big oil major, and he was saying, well, 1.5 to 2 degree doesn't matter, Paris doesn't matter. One of Australia's biggest investors stood up and said, well, we're going to invest in your company on the basis you have a plan to manage for that future. And this is where we need to engage with a broader section of society about how we manage this.
Does an impact in ocean temperature have an effect on carbon dioxide fixation?
That's a very good question that I would need to pass on to an ocean expert. Is there one?
Yes, it does. In the climate models that consider the long-term predictions of CO2 concentrations, etc., the CO2 solubility and some biophysical feedbacks are included in terms of what is the temperature, specifically in the upper layers, doing to the oceanic carbon sink. Oceanic carbon sink is still considered for a longer time to be an actual sink rather than the terrestrial airway, where you have
higher respiration because of the temperature. So it's a more pronounced effect on the land, but of course we have that similar in the ocean. But it is taken into account in the longer term projections, although here with that specific method of the time slices, when do you reach 1.5, 2 degrees, it wouldn't affect these results too much.
Thank you. My name's Robert McLean, I'm from Shepparton. Many of the people who settled there after World War II came from the Mediterranean area, and to me, you painted quite a grim picture for the Mediterranean area. So can I, is it fair or reasonable to equate that with what's going to happen in Shepparton, Northern Victoria? Like they came because our climate was similar to theirs. So.
The answer is yes.
Okay, thank you. Thanks,
Doug. But it's even worse if you're in the southwest of Western Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any study?
Your name and.
Sorry, Peter Ambrose. I'm in sustainability.
Consultant.
Is there any studies planned or in existence between disenfranchisement in communities and the carbon budget and temperatures, etc.? And can we see, because I think that's exactly what you're witnessing in the world, and as much looking at those Thomas Friedman articles in the New York Times that he did on it last year. So that as these temperatures and problems increase, we have a significantly greater disenfranchisement in societies, and that affects the commonwealth of those societies. Is there any studies in existence or happening or predicted to happen in this area?
Just in the Australian context, and I can't speak at a global level, there is, like, the Australian Council of Social Services and the welfare sector have actually been doing quite a lot of work in recent times looking at the impact of extreme events on low-income people and also the organisations that support them. And that's been driven by things like what happened in Queensland with the floods, bushfires and so forth. What we haven't done is join the dots between those, that kind of assessment and that kind of work and what climate change might do. And it's similar with the work that there's a business roundtable which involves Westpac, the Red Cross, some of the insurers. Again, they've for political reasons, to be honest, they didn't include climate change in that work. So that was, and they just looked at what the benefits of early intervention and mitigation or adaptation preparedness to natural disasters was versus just waiting to clean up afterwards. And again, didn't mention climate change. And this is where I think adaptation policy in Australia has got a long way to go. And one of the things that we're very active in engaging with the social sector on is looking at how we can actually build some capacity in the social sector to actually deal with the twin challenges of climate change. A, as we reduce emissions, electricity prices are going to go up. Anyone tells you anything different, they're not telling you the truth. And low-income people will be hit hardest by that, so how do we manage it? And the second part of it is how do we actually develop a national adaptation strategy which looks after the most vulnerable people? Because under Paris, one of the conditions that we have in terms of our national adaptation strategy is that we prioritise looking after vulnerable people and vulnerable ecosystems. And we haven't done that in the past in terms of our national adaptation strategy.
Yeah, me. Hi, I'm Rob. I'm a PhD student at Melbourne Uni. I think there's a lot of people that's taking it back from the science to a very fundamental level. There's a lot of people who like to do something about climate change in the community, and but I guess my question really is how does the average person begin to hold governments to account on climate change policy? For example, when in the recent election campaign, for all intents and purposes, the average person heard nothing about climate change from any of their political leaders.
I'll answer that in two ways. A was just on the election specifically. Like, we have been traditionally very active in elections, and part of the reasons that we're not very popular with some political parties at particular times is that we point out the inadequacy of the policies in national elections. This time around, we decided not to. And I think that's not necessary. And the reason we did that is that if any of the major parties said anything, if made climate change too big of an issue in the election, then the more likely response from certain political parts of the certain parts of our political systems would have been to say things that were really stupid, which would have ruled out more effective action after the election. And hence, we're now in the situation where we have an opportunity for bipartisanship. That said, one of the like I've been working in this issue for 25 years now, quite a lot of that in Australia. And one of the encouraging things that I see is, it's not our role, it's not sort of the work that we do, but I do see across the country more and more local groups getting engaged, engaging with their local members, and I actually started for the first time ever in my 25 years of working in this space in Australia, I feel that the environment sector is actually starting to build capacity and building enough capacity to actually start to impact in the areas that matter. The other thing that I think is really important really comes down to the language that we use. Like, we can't scare people into action. We know that from the research. So you've got to actually point out the risk, but you've also got to give them a pathway to actually deliver a solution. And I think the other part of it also is that one of the other encouraging things that I've seen in the last few years has been that, not necessarily because of climate action, but Australia now has the highest penetration of PV of any developed country on rooftops. Which is one of the reasons we are now having a conversation, one of the many reasons that we're now having a conversation about how we can redesign our national electricity market to make it more fit for purpose in a world that's just going to be decarbonised. And that is in part been driven by the fact that my dad, who doesn't really care a lot about climate change, put solar panels on his roof because he didn't want to pay those dirty energy companies any more money. So there are lots of things that individuals can do which can help impact on national policy.
Three short questions at the end, and we take them all together, or four, and then short answers before we wrap up. Thank you.
Martin from Melbourne Uni. I understand that 1.5 versus 2 degrees is the political discussion, and those are the things you have to focus on, but scientifically, all you could say and show was that 2% is worse than 1.5%. Two degrees is worse than 1.5 degrees, but 1.5 degrees is also worse than 1 degree. So is there anywhere, anything where you can say, this is why we have to be at 1.5 and not at two, because there's something, there is no impact at 1.5, but there is impact at two? Or is there something that has, or would you generally actually like to be at 1 degree? Or is there anywhere, is it all continuous, or is there anywhere a thing where you can say, this is what we need to avoid at all costs?
Thank you. Treat like questions, treat like answers.
How accurate is our knowledge about the lag effect? In other words, if we did achieve 1 or 1.5, how accurate is the science underpinning the amount of time it takes to stabilise at that point without it being exceeded, and what are the underlying assumptions?
Paul Cooper, retired consultant. Great presentation, lots of material. What's your media strategy for breaking this down into really, really understandable bites? I still think it's complex for media to understand.
And one last question here. Thank you.
Are we ignoring the risk of greater sea level rise due to melting ice, which seems to be hard to model?
Good.
Okay.
Sea level rise, media strategy, the safe level, or the lake effect?
Okay, very short answer to safe level. Obviously, 1.5 is not safe either, and it would have been great if we hadn't come to this point to really summarize it. But I mean, the lower we can stabilize it, I think the better. And the part of the study is really to kind of break it down and show it's not just the small island state that's going to be flooded, but it's really for all regions, there's some really severe impacts that we should really try to avoid and stabilize as low as possible. With regard to the stabilization levels, that could be a really long answer, but the very short answer is that it really depends on when we reach a certain, well, and when we reach and which pathway we really embark on. And there's still a lot of additional research that needs to be done on that, especially then on the potential reversibility of impacts and when we do stabilize. But there's a lot of information, but it really depends on the pathway in the short version. Media strategy, well, we did summarize a lot of the results that we have in a recent, very recent paper, actually published last week in Nature Climate Change, that is still very dense and rather complex, and obviously it's not media yet, but yeah. But we do actually have a communications team that deals with that, so no. But yeah, I mean, it's really hard to condense these things because it is.
But they want the information connected to people, so to show the impact on a type of community or people. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. There is more opportunity just to grab here Irvin and Tabea right now after the meeting. Today's seminar was brought to you by the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute, by the Climate Institute, and us, the Australian German Climate and Energy College. If you're interested in doing a PhD or if you know somebody, please come to us.
If
you're interested in supporting the seminar series and future ones, please come to us. Thank you very much. And one last show of hands. You read the Australian or the Financial Review?
Sorry?
There are very few people and then have actually a tremendously good opportunity next week on Friday between 2:30 and 3:30 to change their views, because next week we have a seminar on the myth about the South Australian electricity prices. Is it all to blame on renewables? You can guess the answer. But one of our students, Dylan McConnell, who's with us, the Climate Energy College, as well as the Melbourne Energy Institute, as well as Andrew Stock from the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and the Melbourne Energy Institute Advisory Board, they are going to give here, launch a report that was commissioned by the ACF next week, 2:30 to 3:30, the most comprehensive report yet on a very hot political topic. With that, thank you very much, and one final applause for Tabea.